The Russian Revolution, from Lenin to Stalin. The creation of a working-class Soviet state would not have been possible unless two factors had been drawn together. One was a peasant war against the large landowners, and the other was a working-class revolt directed against the propertied classes. What linked these two processes together was not an identical aim, but the inability of the industrial bourgeoisie to break politically from the large landowners. This inability pushed the peasantry, which in practice meant the army, and the workers into the same camp. The urban revolt could not have succeeded but for the sympathy of the large peasant army. Nor could the peasants have waged a successful struggle unless led and welded together by a centralized external force. Only the working class was capable of providing this leadership. The bourgeoisie and the landowners were expropriated, but the peasant and the workers shared no simple long-term interest. This, and the fact that the proletariat was a minority, preoccupied Russian socialism long before the revolution. They all believed, with the exception of Trotsky and Parvus, that the revolution would be a bourgeois one. In fact, Lenin maintained this view up to April 1917. When he and the Bolsheviks did accept that a social revolution was possible, even though the workers were a minority, it was on the basis that it was the first stage of a worldwide revolution. In February 1917, Lenin wrote that the Russian proletariat cannot by its own force victoriously complete the socialist revolution. And after the revolution, he repeated this basic Bolshevik assumption continually. Quote, "The absolute truth is that without a revolution in Germany, we shall perish." That was from the 7th of March 1918. The 5 years after the revolution saw encouraging signs of world revolution. Communist parties were established in most countries, including the Communist Party of Australia in 1920. In Germany and Austria, military defeat destroyed the monarchy, while in Hungary and Bavaria, Soviet governments took power briefly. An attempted uprising by the German Spartacists resulted in the murder of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. But reformism was too firmly entrenched in most countries for the revolutionary upsurge to be carried through to the establishment of Soviet power. Communist groups with a mass base often failed to act, while those who revolted without this mass base suffered defeat. Within Russia, the Bolsheviks saw revolution abroad and defence of the Soviet Republic as inseparable. Unless this revolution came, Russia would have to be defended against the White Armies and the foreign armies. By a combination of will, organisation and revolutionary spirit, the counter-revolutionary forces were driven out by 1920, but the price paid was enormous. In 1920, the production of pig iron was only 3% of the pre-war level, of hemp 10%, flax 25%, cotton 11%, beets 15%. This resulted in misery, starvation and famine on a wide scale. The decline of the Soviets. Dislocation of production meant dislocation of the working class, which was reduced to 43% of its former numbers. Remember, this was the class that was at the heart of Soviet power, and by the early 1920s, it was under half of its 1917 strength. Industrial output was only 18% of the pre-war figure, and labour productivity only a third of what it had been. Workers were forced to barter with peasants for the necessities of life. Not only was the class decimated, but the very people in the factories had changed. The most militant workers went to fight at the front, while those that survived were required as cadets in the army, the factories, and in the state machinery. Their places were taken by peasants devoid of socialist aspirations. The Bolsheviks had expected to be defeated by the invaders if the revolution didn't spread. The invaders were repulsed, but at the cost of the class that had made the revolution, which was to produce distortions and the degeneration of the Soviets. The Soviets of 1917 were organically connected with the class that had led the revolution. Between representative and worker, there was no gap. When the mass was Menshevik, the Soviets were Mensheviks. When the masses began to follow the Bolsheviks, so did the Soviets. The Bolshevik Party was merely the body of class-conscious militants who could frame policies and provide the lead for working-class action. This was only possible if the mass of workers would follow them. Even opponents of the Bolsheviks recognised this, like Martov, a leading Menshevik, and I'm quoting here. "Understand, please, that before us is a victorious uprising of the proletariat. Almost the entire proletariat supports Lenin and expects its social liberation from the uprising." End of quote. Until the Civil War, this democratic dialogue between the party and the class continued. The Mensheviks continued to operate and compete with the Bolsheviks for support until June 1918. The decimation of the working class changed this. Those who were the lifeblood of the Soviets, the socialist workers, were spread all over Russia. They required coordination by a centralized government apparatus, increasingly independent of their control and controlled by the Soviets. The right-wing social revolutionaries were on the side of counter-revolution. The left social revolutionaries were unreliable allies. The Mensheviks supported the Bolsheviks against the counter-revolution with the demand that the Bolsheviks hand over power to the Constituent Assembly, which was also one of the chief demands of the counter-revolution. Many Mensheviks in practice went over to the side of the whites. The Bolsheviks allowed Menshevik members freedom, but after June 1918 they were not allowed a press. In all this, the Bolsheviks had no choice. They could not allow propaganda to opponents of Soviet power, particularly in a time of civil war, and especially as the working class was less and less organised, so as to be able to determine its own interests. From 1920, the Soviet state was a single-party state, although the Mensheviks continued to operate in the Soviets until 1920. With the end of the Civil War, tensions in Soviet society did not abate, but increased, as the cord that bound workers and peasants was cut. The peasants now had control of the land, free from counter-revolution. They had individual aspirations, which flowed from their productive activity. They sought to improve their own standard of living through their own activities on their own plot of land, and they retained their coherence only in opposing taxes and the forcible collections of grains which the cities demanded of them. Kronstadt. A week before the 10th Congress of the Party in 1921, an uprising of sailors broke out in the Kronstadt fortress. The Kronstadt sailors had been the stoutest defenders of the Bolsheviks, and yet even opponents of the Bolsheviks agreed that the revolt should be put down. Why? Because Kronstadt 1921 was not Kronstadt 1917. Its class composition had changed. Its socialist workers, now spread all over Russia defending the revolution, were replaced by peasants, whose devotion to the revolution was that of their class. And this comes out in their demands, the chief of which were Soviets without Bolsheviks and a free market in agriculture. The latter is easily seen as a peasant demand, but the former is too, for the Bolsheviks were the only consistent supporters of the Soviets. They alone stood consistently for the socialist collective aims of the working class in the revolution. These demands of Kronstadt would have meant liquidation of the socialist aims without a struggle. Kronstadt was not, as some claim, an attack on the socialist content of the revolution, but a desperate attempt to prevent peasant opposition destroying the collective aims of the revolution. Kronstadt was a warning. It questioned the leading role of the working class in the revolution. Concessions to the peasantry were thus required, and this the new economic policy did. Many of the peasant demands were accepted, which allowed a limited range of freedom to private commodity production, while maintaining a strong centralised socialist state apparatus. Changes in the party. The working class had been demoralised and fragmented, and this was also true of the Workers' Party. It too had changed. The men who had made the 1917 revolution by 1919 were only 10% of the party, and by 1922 they were only 2.5%. The party grew, of course, and although there was a tendency for all militant workers to join it, many of the people who joined the party had little or no socialist conviction. This dilution of the party was paralleled by developments in the state. The Bolsheviks had been forced to use thousands of members of the old Tsarist bureaucracy in order to maintain a governmental machine. The Bolsheviks provided the overall direction, but old pre-revolutionary attitudes and elitism towards the masses often prevailed. In 1922, Lenin remarked, "Who is leading who? The 4,700 responsible communists? Or the mass of bureaucrats? Or the other way round? I do not believe you can honestly say the communists are leading this mess. To put it honestly, they are not the leaders, but the led." End of quote. And in the countryside, Bolsheviks were placed in an environment of hostile class forces and bureaucratic inertness, attempts to raise a peasant army and dealing with small traders, kulaks, that is the rich peasants, and the small capitalists. This immediate but limited cooperation with them was often more tangible than their links with a weak and demoralised working class. Bureaucratic modes in the state spread into similar methods in the party. The party of necessity had to act in many situations in place of the class, and so it required an iron discipline within its ranks. Formal factions in the party were temporarily banned at the 10th Congress in 1921, although discussion was to continue within the party. This demand for internal cohesion easily degenerated into bureaucracy in the party. By 1922, Lenin could write, "We have a bureaucracy not only in the Soviet institutions, but in the institutions of the party." End of quote. The erosion of inner party democracy can be seen in the fate of successive oppositions to the central leadership. Lenin himself was in a minority on several occasions, and divisions within the party over the role of the trade unions were openly discussed in the press, and as late as 1921, the programme of the workers' opposition was printed by the party itself. In 1923, the left opposition, led by Trotsky, could still express its views in Pravda, although there was a preponderance of pro-leadership material. Bureaucracy was best seen in the triumvirate of Kamenev, Zinoviev and Stalin, which took over the party leadership during Lenin's illness. When Zinoviev controlled the Leningrad party, he controlled all the delegates, and when he moved into opposition to Stalin, along with Kamenev and Lenin's wife Krupskaya, so did his delegates. By 1923, not only had the workers' position relative to the peasant declined, but also his role in management of industry declined. In 1922, 65% of managerial personnel were workers and 35% were non-workers. Next year, only 36% were workers and 64% were non-workers. These red industrialists began to emerge as privileged groups with high salaries and powers like the power to hire and fire at will, which was inconsistent with the workers' control of industry. In attempting to hold together the young Soviet Republic in the chaos of invasion, civil war, counter-revolution and famine, the socialist intentions determined the course of history. But these intentions were often in a social framework that was hostile to the democratic collectivist aims of socialism. Accommodation and deals with peasants, bureaucrats and mediating between different social classes was bound to reflect itself within the party itself, and party factions began to define their socialist aspirations in terms of the interests of different classes. The only genuinely socialist class, the working class, was the weakest, most disorganized, and the least able to exert pressures. Factions in the party. Let's look at some of the factions within the party. After 1920, it was called the Communist Party, and the social forces behind them. First, the left opposition. This faction adhered most closely to the revolutionary socialist traditions of Bolshevism. It saw workers' democracy as central to socialism and refused to forego the world revolution for the reactionary, chauvinist slogan of building socialism, quote, in one country. The left opposition had three central planks outlined in the new course written by Trotsky and published in 1923. 1. The socialist revolution could only make progress if the economic weight of the towns and industry as against the country and agriculture was increased. This led to the demand for planning in industry and discrimination against the wealthy peasant in taxation policy, who, if not controlled, could by reason of his economic power subordinate the state to his interests. 2. This industrial development had to be accompanied by increased workers' democracy, so as to earn bureaucratic tendencies in the party and the state. 3. Both these policies would enable Russia to remain as a citadel of the revolution. But Russia alone could not produce that material and cultural level that is a prerequisite of socialism. This demanded the extension of the revolution to at least several advanced capitalist countries. Economically, this program was possible. And in fact, industrialization and squeezing of the kulaks was carried out in 1928 by Stalin in a bureaucratic and ruthless manner that contradicted the intentions of the opposition in 1923. However, the class that provided the social basis of the left opposition, the working class, was struck by unemployment, only over one and three quarter million in 1923-4, and its most militant workers had either died in the Civil War or been lifted into the bureaucracy. Added to this, the fact that much of the class was composed of peasants fresh from the countryside, and we find a class that was too tired and dispirited to fight. It was the balance of social forces, not economics, that prevented the party adopting the platform of the left opposition. The opposition to it consisted of two different social forces. The first was made up of those elements who did not see concessions to the peasants as being detrimental to socialist construction. They wanted the party to adjust its program to the needs of the peasantry, and they found their theoretical expression in Buchanan, with his call to the peasants to, quote, enrich themselves. Who supported Stalin? The second tendency that opposed the left opposition drew its strength as much from the social forces within the party as outside, and in the main it was constituted by elements of the party apparatus itself, whose whole orientation was to maintain party cohesion through bureaucratic means. Its chief spokesman was the head of the party apparatus, Joseph Stalin. Stalin, the son of a shopmaker, attended a seminary in his youth. He was appreciated for his practical organizing ability, although Lenin commented that, quote, he lacks the most elementary honesty. And Trotsky said of his intellectual efforts, he is the greatest mediocrity in our party. His role in 1970 was secondary, although Stalin remedied this by rewriting the history of the revolution to give himself a starring role, and his opponents of later years, virtually all of Lenin's associates, a non-existent or malevolent place. With the decimation of the working class, the low level of culture, the reliance on experts, technicians and planners that this necessitated, factory managers, careerists, opportunists, and a whole battery of party functionaries, forced to take responsibilities and decisions as a matter of necessity during the Civil War, now regarded it as a right, and workers' democracy as a hindrance to its exercise. During the 1920s, the entrenched bureaucrats began to accord themselves material privileges. The theoretical justification for this inequality was embodied in the Soviet Constitution of 1936 by the motto, "To each according to his work." This was a comment on what had been established for some time before and constituted an explicit revision of Marx's formula, each according to their needs. This unequal norm of distribution is not a socialist norm, which the Constitution claimed, but it was one gauged according to output. The judge of the value of this output of work was the bureaucrat, who rewarded the intellectuals, the officials, the managers, and of course themselves, in grossly disproportionate amounts. By 1935, the ratio of salaries of high-ranking engineers to those of janitors, porters, and night watchmen was 20 to 1. The triumph of the bureaucracy. The decimation of the working class and the increasing hollowness of the organs of working-class democracy, the Soviets, left power in the state, the army, the police, and the factory in the hands of bureaucrats. The bureaucrats began to deal with those elements that still adhere to the revolutionary socialist tradition. The first confrontation was with the left opposition in 1923, whose chief spokesperson was Leon Trotsky. Abuse replaced debate, while control of the secretariat of the party over appointments was used for the first time to remove sympathisers of the left opposition from their posts. With such bureaucratic manoeuvres came ideological myths to justify such procedures. One was the cult of Leninism, which was bitterly opposed by Lenin's wife, as it elevated Lenin into a semi-divine being who was never wrong. The other was Trotskyism, supposedly opposed to Leninism, which was justified by odd quotes from Lenin of 10, 20 and even longer years ago, while ignoring Lenin's last statements, which described Trotsky as the most able member of the Central Committee and called for the removal of Stalin. Zinoviev, an ally of Stalin at the time, later admitted that these myths were fostered to ward off threats to their control of the party. The bureaucracy saw theory simply as the language of its own ambitions and growing privileges. By 1925, the alliance of Stalin, Zinoviev, and the right-wing peasant supporters had defeated the left opposition. Zinoviev, although an ally, controlled the Leningrad section of the bureaucracy with some degree of independence from the rest of the apparatus. As such, he represented an obstacle to the central bureaucracy and was removed from his leading position in the party. With the fall of Zinoviev, he and Kamenev turned to the historical traditions of the party, now represented by the left opposition. In the meantime, Stalin completes the job of packing all the party secretariats with his creatures, and by 1926 he is master of the party and announces his new policy of, quote, socialism in one country. This revision of a very basic tenet of both Marxism and the Bolshevik Party reflected not the global interests of Soviet society, nor of the world's workers, but of a particular social layer in that society, which is characterized by a basically conservative attitude to the world situation and by a desire to maintain the international status quo. The Soviet Union is no longer seen as an instrument of furthering world revolution, which would have strengthened and relieved the Soviet working class. Rather, the international communist movement is viewed as an instrument to further the twists and turns of Soviet diplomacy. The various communist parties, who each conducted their own witch hunts against Trotskyism, had to ruthlessly sacrifice the militancy, consciousness, and self-confidence of the working class of their respective countries. This slavish following of Stalin's policies led to defeat after defeat for the working class. In China, 1927, Germany, 1928-1933, France, 1936, and brought the Soviet Union to near collapse in the Second World War. The bureaucracy is instinctively afraid of an upsetting of the international status quo, not only for psychological reasons, which reflect its fundamentally conservative nature in Soviet society, but also because it feared and still fears the profound transformation which an extension of the international revolution would provoke, both in the political apathy of the Soviet working class and in the international relationship of forces inside the world communist movement. By 1936, Stalin could say that, quote, it was a tragic, comic misunderstanding to attribute to the Soviet Union plans and intentions of world revolution, end of quote. By 1928, the Stalinist faction had consolidated its control in the party and the state. When Buchanan and the right wing split from it, horrified at what they created, they found themselves with even less strength than the left had had. The bureaucracy had usurped the gains of the revolutionary working class, but the peasantry at this stage remained unaffected. A mass refusal of the peasants to sell their grain brought this home to the bureaucracy. This assertion of the power of the towns over the countryside, which the left opposition had been demanding for years, was in its spirit the opposite what the proposal of the left had decided some years earlier. The left had argued that peasant production must be subordinate to worker-owned industry in the towns. It was the rich peasant who was to provide the capital for the rebuilding and industrialization of the Soviet state. But industry in the towns by 1928 was no longer worker-controlled, but controlled by the bureaucracy, who sought control amidst great suffering over the last part of society outside its control. The first five-year plan began in 1928. Again, this had been advocated by the left opposition some 5 years earlier. industrialization was begun, as was the complete expropriation of the peasantry, the so-called collectivization. Peasants slaughtered their own stock rather than hand them over to the state, whose methods by now were well known. This led to starvation and immense suffering, which was entirely avoidable. Amidst the debacles and betrayals of revolution in China and Europe, the Stalinist bureaucracy tightens its grip over Soviet society. It hounds, persecutes and kills all who by their presence inside and outside Russia constitute a link to the revolutionary traditions of October. Trotsky's son mysteriously falls from a Paris building. Trotsky's secretary is murdered. Trotsky is hounded from country to country by Soviet pressure as he unceasingly exposes the lies of Moscow and is finally murdered by an assassin in Mexico in 1940. But not before the remaining Marxist-Leninists established the Fourth International in 1938, the founding program of which is the Transitional Program. The 30s also sees the great frame-up trials of the surviving old Bolsheviks, men who Lenin knew and worked with over a period of decades. Tomsky, Bukharin, Zinoviev, Rykov, Kamenev, and hundreds of others are accused of being saboteurs, murderers and agents of the Gestapo, and convicted on their own forced confessions. Photos are doctored, history books banned or rewritten to suit the current needs of the bureaucracy. Each month brings fresh accusations and executions of men who were not abject enough, or who could remember what it was like before Stalin, and thousands simply vanish from view without explanation or trial. From the Bolshevik object, as stated by Lenin, quoting, "We shall see the progressive withering away of the state, and the Soviet state will not be a state like the others, but a vast workers' commune," end of quote. To Stalin's rewriting of Marxism, "We advance towards the abolition of the state by way of strengthening of the state," end of quote. What then should our attitude be to the late Soviet Union? Were all the gains of the October Revolution negated by the degeneration of the worker state? The principal gain of the revolution remained until 1989, namely the nationalized property relations. The principle of socialist planning had shown its ability to record results in production unheard of in a short space of time. From 1925 to 1932, the industrial production of Germany diminished 1.5 times. In America, twice. In the Soviet Union, it increased 4 times. Today, despite the bureaucracy, the loss of 20 million men in the Second World War, and the destruction of Soviet industry, the Soviet Union was the second most powerful country on Earth. This bureaucracy that inhabited the Soviet Union could not be called a class because it has a dual and contradictory character. On the one hand, its existence depended upon the preservation of the nationalized property relations, in which it plays merely a parasitic role. Accordingly, it will defend these relations, although this will only be done in a way which corresponds to its own power and privileges. At the same time, its role is conservative, both internationally and locally, because it rests upon the passivity of the Soviet working class. Time for the bureaucracy ran out, as successful revolutions elsewhere threatened Soviet hegemony over the world's communist parties. There were worker revolts in East Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia and Poland, and the growth of dissidents within the Soviet Union, allowing the bourgeoisie to stage the counter-coup they did in the late 80s, and the Soviet Union died.